This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Wes Anderson is the director of some of my favorite movies of recent years: The Grand Budapest Hotel, The Royal Tenenbaums, and Rushmore. So imagine how I felt when I learned that the subject of his new movie was a very familiar magazine.
It began as a holiday. Arthur Howitzer Jr., college freshman, eager to escape a bright future on the Great Plains, convinced his father, proprietor of the Liberty, Kansas Evening Sun, to fund his transatlantic passage as an educational opportunity to learn the family business through the production of a series of travelogue columns to be published for local readers in the Sunday Picnic magazine.
The magazine in this film, and the title of the film itself, is The French Dispatch. And it bears a very striking resemblance to The New Yorker in its earliest days.
Over the next 10 years, he assembled a team of the best expatriate journalists of his time and transformed Picnic into The French Dispatch, a factual weekly report on the subjects of world politics, the arts, high and low, fashion, fancy cuisine, fine drink, and diverse stories of human interest set in faraway quartiers. He brought the world to Kansas.
The film presents four distinct stories from this fictional publication, and each is inspired in one way or another by a classic essay from The New Yorker. And the cast of The French Dispatch is pretty amazing. It's a movie where even the small parts are played by the likes of Saoirse Ronan and Willem Dafoe. So I was eager to sit down with Wes Anderson, along with one of the film's real stars, Jeffrey Wright. You have to imagine, when I heard that this movie was being made, I don't know how many years ago it was, I was terrified. You know, my beloved New Yorker is going to be made into a movie. I didn't know what it was going to be about. And then I heard that it was Wes Anderson making it, and I was pretty thrilled. I just want to know about the origin of this film, why you decided to make a movie about a magazine that I think we can agree is kind of like the early New Yorker.
Yes, it's true. I always wanted to do a movie about The New Yorker, but the thing that always happens to me is I have one idea I'm sort of tinkering with over the years, and then I have another idea, and then somehow I just mix them together, and I just combine them. They don't necessarily, they tend to be suited to each other, but I don't know why. And in this case, it was I wanted to do a French movie. And I had this idea of wanting to do a New Yorker movie. And somehow I also had this thought I wanted to do a movie that was one of those omnibus type things where it was a collection of short stories. And they all got brought together in this. And, you know, I've had this almost fetishistic interest in the New Yorker since I was 17 years old or so. I have UC Berkeley, when they sold off their hard copies, you know, the bound ones that you used to find in the libraries, we bought them. So I have hundreds of issues from Berkeley and then from some other sources. yeah, and, I love to go back and, you know, now there's the digital archive, which is utterly complete. But I still like to go look at the
It doesn't smell the same, does it?
Not at all.
No.
Not even remotely.
Now,
no.
So in the movie, the magazine is the French Dispatch, which isn't exactly the New Yorker. How would you describe the relationship between the two magazines, the one that you conceived and the real thing?
Well, ours is a sort of expatriate magazine, maybe like a bit of Paris Review mixed into it. And the writers are all American writers who've gone to live in France. And there are a lot of inspirations for that from the New Yorker. It's those New Yorker writers in particular who were sending their dispatches from France at different periods of the magazine that ended up kind of being some of the models for our main characters, who are all writers.
Now, Jeffrey, your character, Roebuck Wright, seems to be kind of an amalgam of figures. I think you can pretty clearly see James Baldwin in there. And there's also notes of A.J. Liebling, who's known as one of the great food writers of that era, or of any era at all.
Yeah, a bit of those. You know, Wes talked about a bit of Tennessee Williams thrown in, just a kind of gumbo of certain characters. And in this case, yeah, I did go back and read Baldwin, read old New Yorker food reviews, read a bit. But he's not Baldwin. Borrow from, but he's something else. There are characteristics that are similar. He's black. He's gay. He's searching for a type of freedom at a time when those things can be inhibitors to his freedom in America, certainly. Baldwin was not one who devoted, the majority of his later years, at least, to writing on food. That's a major departure. He does have a history that we touch on of writing about civil rights and race, but he finds himself in the corner of a restaurant, alone. And I think this story becomes, in some ways, or his story becomes more of a portrait of kind of his existential relationship to aloneness. It becomes something else. And so a part of the research was about understanding the expatriate journey at that time. To a place like provincial France or like our town Anhui. So I tried to understand how this amalgam of these ideas might find his way there.
Yeah, I don't think we could presume to give him the gravity of Baldwin. It was always a bit of homage, but. But there's this piece equal in Paris, which is an inspiration.
Jeffrey, you were kind enough to record an excerpt from that Baldwin essay, Equal in Paris.
The very word institutions from my side of the ocean, where it seemed to me we suffered so cruelly from the lack of them, had a pleasant ring as of safety and order and common sense. One had to come into contact with these institutions in order to understand that they were also outmoded, exasperating, completely impersonal, and very often cruel. Similarly, the personality, which it seemed from a distance to be so large and free, had to be dealt with before one could see that, if it was large, it was also inflexible and, for the foreigner, full of strange, high, dusty rooms which could not be inhabited. One had, in short, to come in contact with an alien culture in order to understand that a culture was not a community basket weaving project, nor yet an act of God, was something neither desirable nor undesirable in itself, being inevitable, being nothing more or less than the recorded and visible effects on a body of people of the vicissitudes with which they had been forced to deal.
Jeffrey, what do you make of that passage?
As it relates to our story, it speaks to I think, Roebuck's desire for a room of his own, for a table of his own. Even in exile, he realizes that he's only at home within himself, that there is no home for him. And maybe there is no home for anyone, really, other than within one's own body and one's own soul. Maybe that is his ultimate political act, is to, at least in some small space, be himself and be pleased with it.
Yeah. Wes, you know, there are some writers that you read who change their approach and their style from novel to novel. Same with filmmakers. And then there are filmmakers and novelists who have a very recognizable rhythm, style, look, cast of characters. And I, you know, I don't mean to be presumptuous. I think you fit in the latter category.
I've been told that.
And the visual style of a Wes Anderson movie is so recognizable so quickly, and also on the page as well. And I think to some extent the way you're telling the actors to approach that, how did you invent that?
Well, I would say, first of all, I don't tell the actors much of anything. I mean,
reverse. Can I jump in there?
Yeah, please do. I think maybe we need some fact checking.
Because I only know what it's like on my movies. So maybe it's better if Jeffrey gives a little perspective.
Wes is wonderfully reserved, sometimes a bit hesitant, you know.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes he's a gentle guy. On set, he's a gentle general. there's a clarity and a purpose that comes out of him and a sense of belonging that is really, really wonderful to behold. And he's exacting and he's a taskmaster in the best way. So yeah, Wes, you offer a lot of very useful input. And particularly here, because obviously he's got this, you know, this very specific vision in his head and he wants that to be realized. So yeah, you offer a bit here and there, Wes.
This is interesting fact-checking department, because Harold Brodkey, the late writer Harold Brodkey, once described William Shawn, who was the second and very long-time editor of The New Yorker, as a combination of St. Francis Assisi and Napoleon Bonaparte. So it sounds like a little bit like what you're describing here in the nicest terms. But Wes, go back to the Wes Anderson-ness of every Wes Anderson movie. Where does that come from? Or does it just emanate from you the way, you know, sweat would?
Well, possibly something like the sweat, I think. I think it's like, for me, every movie I feel I'm doing something completely new. We're starting from scratch. We're in a new nation. And I never think about what might make the movie like other movies I've done, except to say, this is too close. I'm repeating myself too much here, but I never make any effort to have a style that unifies my movies. I think it's more something that I'm stuck with, I think.
So you write, and that's done in solitude with some collaboration, but you're directing, but it's a communal enterprise, finally. You're handing over this script to a lot of different and disparate talents, whether it's set directors or actors or whomever. I mean, it's a big operation, and you've got to trust other people. I have to do that all the time. And I talk to a writer, we settle on a subject, on a project, but finally, that writer goes off and it's up to his or her imagination and efforts and energies and, you know, whatever the hell is going to happen, happens. It's an odd combination of individual and communal enterprise.
Well, there are so many ways that sort of comparison applies to directing movies, but maybe the biggest one is when I have a tendency to very carefully plan everything. When it comes to the day that we're filming, I've sort of got everything well figured out and everybody knows. But the biggest thing to me that's like how each writer has a voice at the magazine is ultimately there are these guys who are going to be in the movie. These men and women are going to play these parts. And, I think of this, like, you know, this character, Roebuck Wright, was written for Jeffrey Wright. But there was one day where we had a scene where he's walking through this whole police station, and it's a long, long take. It's a big shot that goes from room to room with hundreds of extras and so on. And it's supposed to be a voiceover. And we shot it a bunch of times because, you know, it was complicated. And after, and we said, okay, well, that's it. We've got, you know, it can't be done any better than this. And then I said, well, the only way it could be done better would be if Jeffrey said it all on camera. So rather than it being a scene where there's a voiceover as he travels through this place, he actually tells the story as he walks through and interacts with all these dozens of people. And that's not really something you're meant to spring on somebody.
that was news to me. Yeah,
and it sounds
that
hard.
Morning. Yeah. And
yeah, but you were like a ball player saying, "Give me the ball, coach, and I'll just take it over." I mean, that's pretty impressive.
It was pages of that, but Jeffrey, okay, I think if you give me a few minutes, yes, I think I can do it.
Yeah, it just kind of like, you know, launched into my hard drive and was there, and just, you know, I just sang it. Yeah.
And we started doing it. And as soon as we did the first bit of it, I was like, we're not leaving here until we make this happen, because this is completely transforms it. And it was, you know, it was nothing. I hadn't planned any of it. It just was me knowing him and seeing what was happening in the moment. And it changed the scene completely.
Still was tricky, though, but we got there.
That was great.
I'm talking with Wes Anderson, whose new film is called The French Dispatch, and with Jeffrey Wright, one of its stars. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. We'll continue in a moment.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The French Dispatch is the new film written and directed by Wes Anderson. It's his 10th feature. The film stars Jeffrey Wright, Frances McDormand, Tilda Swinton, and Owen Wilson as writers at a magazine that's very similar to The New Yorker, except it's in France. And I've been speaking with Jeffrey Wright and Wes Anderson. So there's another character played by Frances McDormand, Lucinda Kremens, who seems to have bits of Mavis Galan, Janet Flanner, maybe a little Lillian Ross. How do you build a character like that out of the raw materials? What was the story of the conception there?
You know, Mavis Galan, I knew her stories, some of the stories. There's so many. But I read this piece, her pieces on May 68, maybe it's two articles on May 68, her journal about it. reading it, I realized where we live in Paris. We live near Boulevard Montparnasse, and I sort of got that this was where she was. It was like, I think when she says she's going home, that's right down around the corner. I kind of got hooked by this idea that she was in the neighborhood, and I never met her. She died before I met her, but I kind of figured out what her table was at Le Dôme down the street. And I just became kind of fixated on her. And so the character we wrote is not Mavis Gallant. It's a mixture. But it was Mavis Gallant was the first impulse for it. And then also the idea of it being somebody who's observing what's going on in her very unusual perspective on it. And we quote her in it, actually.
Well, we've got a recording of Frances McDormand reading from Gallant's essay. So let's listen to a little bit of that.
May 4th. HT caught in traffic jam around Saint-Germain-Saint-Michel in midst of student disorders. Says this is different. They all seem very young. He sees a barricade made of parked cars they have moved away from the curb. Is very impatient. Hates disorder. Talk with MB. She saw the police charge outside the Balzar Brasserie. Says their apartment full of tear gas. They live on the 5th floor. Wouldn't let her daughter talk on the telephone in sight of windows. Police think nothing of throwing grenades into houses. Doubt if they could throw one up to the 5th floor. Says gas makes it impossible to sleep at night. Crowds, traffic jams, see a crowd. I feel the mixture of tension and curiosity that is always a signal of something happening, and I hear shouting and see police cars. I duck into Saint-Germain Metro. I hate these things. See more pictures and papers and accounts, surprising, of how the students, far from fleeing, regroup and charge.
Now, there's a certain resonance of what's been going on more lately, and your treatment of it, abstracted and remixed as it is, still has this legitimate undercurrent about disaffected young people striking back at the status quo. Wes, I don't normally think of you as a distinctly political filmmaker, but was it interesting to you to have this kind of thing come into your work here?
Well, one thing I love about the way she talks about them, which you start to get from that, but she expands on this. You know, it's natural to her and not unexpected that she finds the things that are ridiculous in what the kids are saying. But she does not identify with her peers, with the people her age, who are actually against them. She's very sensitive to how brave they are. And it's interesting. She's a great character in it, and you get the feeling she's not really like anybody else among her group of friends and the people she knows well in Paris then.
Jeffrey, as we were talking about before, your character too, although is a gourmand, but also touches on issues of race, homophobia, policing, the experience of immigrants abroad. Do you find the picture, The French Dispatch, to be political, and if so, to what degree? How?
I'm not sure if it. Well, let me back up. I tend to think everything's political. So, yes. So, yes, in certain ways. But as far as this story, that was a question that I tried to answer. Is a black man and a gay man who has left segregated America, Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act America, America that's, you know, emerging into this new conversation about race, is that man writing in a, you know, in ennui France about food? Is that a political decision? I think for him it is. It's a political act. But it's a poetic one. Some might argue that those are equally powerful as the legislative acts or the more militant acts. But it's a question that the story raises. You know, in the midst of all of the varieties of dissent, where does he find himself?
Do you think of your own work as an actor, as an artist? As political, maybe not as in a primary way, but in an important way?
Well, I think that the images that we put out, the stories that we put out have impact, and they have impact on a political level. Yes, they inform people's thinking about themselves, about those around them, community and society. And so they're powerful. Yes. Even the most, you know, kind of banal Hollywood film is political, and the choices that are made about, you know, who is defined as heroic, who's villainous, who's marginalized, who's powerful. Yeah, all of these things have implicit or sometimes explicit political overtones. So maybe that's the filter that I view the world through and view these things through, but I think it's inevitable.
It's inevitable. I mean, it's the movies reflect and they actually influence. I mean, I'm not saying one movie has a great influence, but who has seen The Celluloid Closet?
Oh, yeah.
Do you know this film? Yes.
Yeah, sure.
The Celluloid Closet is a documentary about the image of gay people in movies, in the history of movies. I mean, this movie really shows you how these images, the way people are imaged in the course of time, it tells you a lot about the time they were living in, the time when these movies are made, which in a kind of unusual way, because you're looking right at them and there they are speaking and here they are behaving, and it's something a bit different from writing. And then you can see how this evolves and how significant the change is in the course of time. Anyway, I recommend this movie to people who haven't seen it, because I just saw it.
Yeah. So the editor is played by Bill Murray. And the editor's name is Arthur Howitzer Jr. I love Howitzer for an editor, just, you know, a kind of, you know, big gun.
Yes.
Is it fair to say that that's based at least in part on Harold Ross?
Yeah, well, you know, I guess it was a bit of Ross and a bit of Sean.
William Sean, his successor.
Yeah. But, you know, with Ross, we have this thing where the relationship with the writers is love-hate, and he's tearing his hair out. And Sean, it's... you really only feel that it's the love side of it. Our guy is somebody who's devoted to his writers. To him, they're the center of his life.
We've got a clip from Bill Murray, who plays Arthur Howitzer in the movie, and he's reading a letter from the real-life Harold Ross, the co-founder of The New Yorker.
This is the most difficult magazine in the world to get out, and it involves, I think, more people in contact with them than any other. It's appalling. When you count up the people in the office, artists, humorists, fiction writers, idea men, agents, fact writers, you have a total of 200 or 300. Moreover, the turnover is heavy. A lot of promising young people around here are gone after a fairly short while, writing for the movies or other magazines or somewhere. You do me only one injustice. I don't try to scare anyone, although I don't give a damn if I do, probably. I didn't try to scare you. The profanity was natural.
Now, the film starts with Howitzer's death, and he puts it in his will that the magazine should stop publication when he dies. The real guy, Harold Ross, made a very different choice. He was very ill in the early 50s, and he handed The New Yorker over to his deputy at that time, William Sean. Why kill off the French Dispatch along with its editor, he said defensively.
It just seemed like the thing to do at the time. I don't really know.
Don't kill us off, for God's sake.
Well, I have been asked the question before by Bill Murray, who said, why would I do this? I didn't really have an answer for him. I mean, to me, it's selfish, I guess. It's just a made up story.
Oh, I've heard that. Now, this film has been delayed in its release for quite a long time, right?
Yes.
It must be a strange thing to have something submerged for so long.
You know, it was strange for a while, and then the strangeness sort of became irrelevant.
Kind of overrun by other strangenesses.
Yes.
Slightly more important.
Yes, the world really kept up its end of the bargain.
Were the two of you able to work during the pandemic, Jeffrey?
I was working on Batman until March 13th of 2020. Then we went on a 2-week hiatus that extended until September. So went back early September and finished March 13th, I believe, of 2021.
It's for me, the timing was we couldn't release our movie, so I started writing a next thing. So I'm about to go to work on a new movie. Jeffrey's in this movie. But I have not emerged, is the answer.
Well, come out wherever you are.
Have you worked
light.
from home mostly, or have you been going into the magazine every day?
No. I'm at my desk in my apartment where I've been working and doing this show for now, what, a year and 2/3 or something like that? Anyway, but more important, The French Dispatch comes out next month, and I really look forward to it. It's a brilliant movie. Thank you so much, Jeffrey Wright and Wes Anderson.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Now, we have a special French Dispatch bonus for you on our podcast. Some of the actors from the film reading classic essays from The New Yorker. Elizabeth Moss reads E.B. White. Owen Wilson reads a terrifying piece about rats by Joseph Mitchell. And Tilda Swinton reads Calvin Tompkins. And there's more. To listen, search for The New Yorker Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts. More to come this hour, so stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
So, Senator Harris, Mr. Harris, what would you prefer that I call you?
Either way, it's whatever Senator Harris, I suppose. But a former senator asked me after I started teaching at the university, what do your students call you? And I said, what do you mean? They call you professor or senator? And I had to think a minute. And I said, most of them call me Fred.
Fred Harris is a former senator from Oklahoma, a 2-time presidential candidate, and a professor of political science. He's 90 this year. And he's the last surviving member of the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders. Lyndon Johnson had assembled the commission to look into the causes of an uprising in Detroit in 1967.
Offices, banks, schools, businesses, industry were closed down. The heart of Detroit was deserted. Deliveries were curtailed. Food ran short. All normal activities in the nation's fifth largest city were at a standstill.
The commission's findings were stark. In a document known as the Kerner Report, they said that America was moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. This was not at all what President Johnson wanted to hear, and he refused to meet with his own commission to discuss the report. A concise version has been republished and edited with an introduction by staff writer Jelani Cobb.
The original Kerner report was huge. It ran more than 700 pages. and it called for sweeping changes to the infrastructure of American cities, to the ways that American institutions interacted with low-income people of color. For instance, they called for the creation of 2 million new jobs and 6 million new units of affordable housing. They wanted to revamp the welfare system. They wanted to eliminate de facto school segregation. They wanted to fundamentally change the way policing was handled, particularly in low-income communities and communities of color. One of the more prescient things that they called for was the diversification of the media, which is a conversation that's still ongoing. And so the conclusions were hard for President Johnson. He knew, politically speaking, that it was just unpalatable, you know, for most white Americans to hear that the problems, as the report said, the problems that faced people in these communities could be laid directly at the doorstep of white America. None of its recommendations were enacted. None of its suggestions ever became legislation or made it off the drafting board, in a sense. It's possible that the Kerner report is even more relevant than it was at the time that it was released. When we look at the questions that arose last summer in the midst of the chaotic and angry protests that filled the streets of dozens, hundreds of American cities after the death of George Floyd, we were fundamentally examining the same questions that Kerner grappled with half a century earlier. And this report was the unheeded warning. I was happy to speak with former Senator Fred Harris about his experience being one of the 11 members on the Kerner Commission. So you get a call one evening at home from President Lyndon Johnson. Can you tell us a little bit about that call and how the Kerner Commission came to be formed?
Yes, at the height of one of the worst disorders of 1967, soon it was announced that Johnson was going to have a national telecast and appoint the commission. And so we brought a television into our living room and had some neighbors come over just to hear the president. And he called and he said, I'm going to appoint that commission. He actually said, I'm going to appoint that damn commission you've been talking about. That was his exact words. And he said, I'm going to put you on it. He said, let your search be free, find the truth, and express it in your report. And he asked us to answer three questions. What happened in these riots or disorders or violent protests? Secondly, why did it happen? And thirdly, what can we do to keep it from happening again and again? And then he said, I want you to remember that you're a Johnson man. I said, yes, sir, I am a Johnson man. I'm standing up at a wall telephone in my kitchen, and I'm almost saluting. I said, yes, sir, I am a Johnson man.
What do you think he meant by that?
I don't know exactly, but he didn't want me to go wild and be critical and so forth, I suppose. He then said, if you forget it, I'm going to take my pocket knife and cut your blank off. He did not say blank. He said, you understand that kind of talk, don't you, Fred? And I said, yes, sir. And Johnson later felt I did forget it.
So the commission, once it was staffed, held a series of formal hearings for 20 days.
That's right.
And you interviewed people from Martin Luther King to J. Edgar Hoover.
Right.
Do you recall some of the people who testified and what some of the more notable or memorable testimony was during those hearings?
I do remember Kenneth Clark, as you know, a famous sociologist.
Psychologist, right. Mm-hmm.
He was very sort of skeptical about the whole thing, and it was a kind of a downer for us. He said, what's this commission going to do? Is this the same old thing keeps happening, and you make these reports and nothing occurs, nothing happens. That had been the McCone Commission report about the Watts riot from 1965. And a lot of people felt that way, that we don't need more studies. Nothing's going to come out of that commission.
Can you give me a sense of what you think Lyndon Johnson's motives were in creating the commission?
I think they were really sincere. He was deeply committed to do something about racism and poverty in the country. I think these were core commitments of his. He felt very deeply about it. And as we know, or as surely we know, he did more against poverty and against racism than any president before or since. Mm-hmm. And so it's really a shame that he wound up, as he did, rejecting the report itself.
What's fascinating about this is that, the report is, this incredible indictment, of the institutional racism that had factored into, what they kind of politely termed civil disturbances.
Right.
At that time. But, really, it was a preface to even bigger events that would happen, because the report was published just about a month before Martin Luther King died.
Right.
And can you talk to me about, that moment and, what happens in the aftermath of King's assassination? Was there a sense that you all had been kind of shouting into the wilderness?
The way we adopted this report was every word of it was read, was first presented to us, a segment of it, in draft form by our excellent staff, headed by the wonderful David Ginsberg, now gone. But that was read aloud with it printed in front of us, and then we voted on. And so when we got to that stage where we said the Negro, as we said in those days, have always known, but white people do not understand, is that white racism caused these black ghettos, and it's white racism that sustains it. Now, there were people on our commission who said, well, they wanted to use words like intolerance or discrimination or whatever. We thought it was important to say racism, and we thought it was important that we say it particularly for black young people. We knew that oppressed people very often come to have the same, believe the same bad stereotypes about themselves that the dominant community does. And we wanted to say to them, you're not crazy. You're in a system that where racism is systematic and is a part of the system. We voted on that. The chair of the commission, Otto Kerner, had taken the position that he would vote only if there was a tie. But he voted with us more progressive members, and that passed by a vote of 6-5.
Wow. It's interesting because there's this paradox that, the report and its recommendations are ignored by the president who commissioned them, but they are widely and wildly embraced by the public. The report is a New York Times bestseller.
That's right.
Was that response from the public a surprise? And what was the rationale or the thinking behind publishing it and putting out to the public with a trade publisher in the first place? I believe it was Bantam Press that published it.
We were a little worried that this commission, like this report, might just be shelved or even suppressed. And as we approved a segment of the report and voted on it, we sent that segment to Bantam Books, and they were able to put it together in a really heroic effort and bring out the report the very day we released it, on March the 1st, 1968. But the report was leaked, and there was just a mad scramble when it came out, and we tried our best to stop the publication of it by the Washington Post, but they said they had it legally, and all of that caused us a lot of trouble. So that the headlines were "White Racism Cause of Black Riots, Commission Says." And I've said this several times, but my dad, who came from Mississippi, he was a small farmer in those days, 68, southwest Oklahoma. He loved me, of course. He didn't quite understand what I was involved in. But the way he heard that report, he almost used these words, was, "Mr. Harris, out of the goodness of your heart, you ought to pay more taxes to help poor black people who are rioting in Detroit." And my dad literally said, "To hell with that! I'm already paying too much tax and not getting anything out of it." And he was right about that. He did not know that we also said that what we were recommending applied to everybody, white people, black people, and other minorities, American Indians, we said, Hispanic surname, as we said in those days, and other minorities, rural and urban, all of that, we said.
Do you think that was representative, your father's sentiments? Do you think that was representative of how other white people viewed the commission and its recommendations?
I think so. And there was a poll along in that time, even after the Kerner report, when asked a question, do you think that there is something like systematic mistreatment of black people in America? Overwhelming majority of black people said yes, but a majority of white people said no. And it's a shame that our 20 days of hearings were not public hearings. Nobody even thought about it in those days, you know.
Do you have a sense of why Johnson was invested in the idea that there was some sort of subterfuge or conspiracy, you know, whether it was from communists or what they would have called black militants at that time?
Well, I don't know exactly, although a lot of people were saying that. I think Johnson's feelings were hurt in a way. You know, what's the matter with these people? I've given them the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and we've got the poverty program. And here they still cause trouble. Mm-hmm. And you know, he just felt in a way kind of betrayed, I think. And so it must be, you remember there's that old thing they used to call in the South, the happy darky syndrome.
Oh, wow.
You know, mm-hmm. Where white people said, well, I don't know, our black people are happy. You know what?
Sure.
There has to be these outside agitators that are coming in here and stirring them up, like the NAACP and so forth in those days. They, first of all, I said, there are thousands of Stokely Carmichaels and H. Ralph Browns that you and I have never heard of. Mm-hmm. And the conditions in which these people live and the rightful hostility they have toward the police, often the only aspect of the general society that they come in contact with, is such that there's no telling what would happen or how long it would happen.
You know, there have been dozens of these reports now. Certainly the Kerner Commission report is the most comprehensive of them. But it almost constitutes a genre of government document that dates at this point more than a century, these examinations. How do you think we go from diagnosis to actually resolving these issues?
Well, I think we're in the process of doing it. You know, Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden got together after it became clear that Biden was going to be the Democratic nominee and worked out what came to be the Democratic platform. And it is by far, I'm a former national chairman of the Democratic Party, it's by far the most progressive platform in the history of the Democratic Party, by far. And public opinion has changed. It's changed in regard to race, and it's changed in regard to what are real solutions to these problems, the kind of conclusions we came to in the Kern Report. And that's what's made the Kern Report last. We really did tell the truth. You know, we could have said, well, we do a little of this and a little of that, and maybe things will get better. We knew that wasn't true. And so we decided, okay, we're not going to ask what it'll cost or whether people are going to all agree with it or what. We're going to say what we know is the truth. We have to do really big things and make big, big changes in American society and government. Case after case of these terrible use of force and killings by the police, all of that somehow has brought us to a time where, I mean, the country is split like hell, but the majority of this country, as we saw with Biden's election, now believe that we've got to do big things.
Well, thank you for your time. This has been incredibly insightful, and it's such an honor to get to talk to you today.
Well, thank you. It's the same for me too about you.
That's Jelani Cobb speaking with the former senator, Fred Harris. Jelani is co-editor of the essential Kerner Commission report, which just came out this year. You can read him on history and racial justice and much more at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Now, remember, if you're a movie buff, we've got something very special for you on our podcast. Cast members of Wes Anderson's The French Dispatch are reading some of the stories that inspired the film in the first place. Bill Murray, Owen Wilson, Jeffrey Wright, and others, including Elizabeth Moss, who reads E.B. White's tribute to the New Yorker's founder, Harold Ross.
His ambition was to publish one good magazine, not a string of successful ones, and he thought of the New Yorker as a sort of movement. He came equipped with not much knowledge and only two books, Webster's Dictionary and Fowler's Modern English Usage. These books were his history, his geography, his literature, his art, his music, his everything. Some people found Ross's scholastic deficiencies quite appalling and were not sure they had met the right man. But he was the right man, and the only question was whether the other fellow was capable of being tuned to Ross's vibrations. Ross had a thing that is at least as good as, and sometimes better than, knowledge. He had a sort of natural drive in the right direction, plus a complete respect for the work and ideas and opinions of others.
You can find that on the podcast of the New Yorker Radio Hour. That's our show for today. Thanks so much for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen and Putubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino.
And we had additional help from Harrison Keithline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.